this mic working? I think it is. You can all hear me? Yes? Nobody? Yes, in the back you can hear. Thank you. Good afternoon. It's my pleasure to welcome you today to this talk by Nancy Birdsall, The Crisis Next Time, U.S. Leadership at the Pittsburgh G20 Summit and Beyond. I want to extend a special welcome to our discussants, Tim Adams and Francis Fukuyama. I'm Lawrence McDonald, Vice President for Communications and Policy Outreach at CGD. Today's event epitomizes two traits that are the core of what makes the Center for Global Development an unusual place. First, as those of you who know Nancy will have already guessed, her talk today begins with a deep concern for the well-being of the poorest people on the planet, and a real preoccupation with practical changes in the policies of the rich and powerful that can make it less difficult for those very poor people to improve their lives. Second is you. Our work at CGD does not exist in a vacuum. It's part of an ecosystem of ongoing policy discussions here in Washington and around the world. We have structured today's event to include ample time for your questions and comments, and I hope that you will discover some ideas today that you will take back with you when you leave. Nancy's background reflects the combination of rigorous research and hands-on policy experience that is a hallmark of the center's work. As the executive vice president of the Inter-American Development Bank, she was responsible for a $30 billion portfolio in public and private sector lending. Before that, for 14 years, she worked at the World Bank, including as the director of the Policy Research Department. She is a prolific writer, the author, co-author, and editor of more than a dozen books and more than 100 academic articles. What Nancy proposes today, what she will propose today, may strike some of you as unlikely. But we live in extraordinary times. And some of you may recall that when Nancy called for $1 trillion for the donors and multilateral financial institutions to mobilize an additional $1 trillion to help developing countries weather the financial crisis, that too seemed unlikely, but it happened. When, or maybe I should say if, it comes to pass, that is what she's going to propose today, you'll be able to say you heard it here first. Please welcome Nancy Birdsall.
Thank you very much, Lawrence. What a wonderful introduction. I would like to begin by thanking Lawrence as well as other colleagues at CGD. These are my own views. As many of you know, at the center, we don't take positions qua center. On the other hand, what I'll be talking about reflects an enormous amount of sharing and discussion with my colleagues, not just in the recent weeks, but over several years. What a difference a year can make. Last September, the U.S. financial crisis was spreading with alarming speed to global markets. Many people feared that the world would fall into a long, deep recession, perhaps comparable to the Great Depression. The global economy appeared to teeter on the brink of an abyss. The crisis gave fresh impetus to overdue changes in global governance. That's one good thing that happened. An expanded group of nations, the G20, met for the first time at the head of government level, overshadowing the embarrassingly outmoded G8 as a setting for tackling global problems. In Washington last November, and then in London this spring, the G20 heads of government put their collective weight behind a coordinated response, including a pledge to make an unprecedented $1 trillion available to developing countries to ensure they could participate as well in what became a global stimulus package. Attention in Pittsburgh in a few weeks will focus on when and how to exit from the stimulus policies and on banking issues, on trade and financial services regulation. These are important issues. Poor people in the developing world are being hit hard by the crisis. The underlying causes have not yet been addressed, and the recovery is not yet fully assured. But to make the summit a success, the heads of government must look beyond the current crisis and begin to prepare for the crisis next time. We don't yet know what form this crisis will take or when it will hit. We do know that our thoroughly integrated global economy, for all its benefits, is far from risk-free, that the looming threat of climate change creates additional and dangerous risks, and that both of these have special potential for devastating harm to poor people around the world. And we know that the premier global institution of international development cooperation, the World Bank, is poorly designed to meet those challenges. The World Bank's country-focused lending model and its outdated governance structure leave it ill-equipped to deliver the global public goods, from combating trade protectionism and global epidemics to investing in research on renewable energy and climate-resilient crops that all nations need but none can provide on its own. Last weekend in London, the finance ministers of Brazil, Russia, India, and China urged the G20 to become the primary steering group on global financial and economic issues. I agree. To do so, the G20 must articulate a consensus on the roles of the World Bank and other multilateral financial institutions and nudge them to become much more creative and flexible in providing global public goods. Today, I want to offer two proposals for the G20 in Pittsburgh to look beyond the current crisis and follow through on their pledge in the London communique to make the global economy, quote, green, sustainable, and inclusive. Because the G20 and other world leader summits are declaring and committing bodies rather than implementing bodies, both of my proposals involve providing instructions to international institutions. Let me mention the two. First, the G20 leaders should pledge to begin working together well before their next summit in Seoul on reaching a consensus on the functions and institutional mechanisms, institutional architecture needed to implement a global climate accord, including fresh thinking about the potential role of the World Bank. Second, because climate change and globalization have greatly heightened risks for the world's poor, the G20 leaders should call on the multilateral development banks to become much more active in offering countries innovative risk management tools, such as insurance against natural disasters and bonds indexed to their terms of trade. I'm going to explain now why I think each of these proposals is crucial to shared global prosperity, and especially to the well-being of the 5 billion poor and near-poor people on our planet, and suggest the implications of each for the multilateral banks. I'll then tell you why I believe that the U.S. should raise these issues in Pittsburgh and work with other G20 members to address them well ahead of the 4th G20 summit in Seoul next spring. Let me go to the climate issue. Why focus on climate? And why worry about implementation when an international accord still hasn't been reached? There are many other problems that are neglected because of their nature as, fundamentally because of their nature as global public goods or bads, that I would have liked to put forward for G20 consideration. Much of our work at CGD on global health, energy and agriculture, and on food security falls into that category of global public goods. A sampling of our work, by the way, is available outside, and I urge you to take some home with you when you leave. The thing is that climate stands out from these others because it is a new issue, comparatively. The institutional arrangements for climate are still unsettled, and because without action in the next few years, irreversible climate change could wipe out much of the development progress of the past and put future progress, especially in the low-income countries that are not represented in the G20, at grave risk. Here's what we know, as summarized in recent CGD working papers by David Wheeler and colleagues. about the problems the world will face if greenhouse gas emissions continue unabated. As the planet gets steadily warmer, the sea levels will rise. They're already rising. Some areas will be hit much harder than others. A 1 foot rise in sea level, likely within 30 years, will submerge large areas of the Nile Delta. Coastal storms will intensify. Millions of people in Asia's low-lying coastal cities will be in critical danger from typhoon-driven storm surges. Everywhere, weather will be more variable, with more intense rainfall in some places and more intense droughts in others. Agriculture will be hard hit. A CG study by Bill Klein projected that India and parts of Africa will suffer agriculture productivity losses of 40% or greater by 2080. What is even more disturbing is that all these problems will strike developing countries and poor people especially severely, for three reasons. Developing countries are in higher risk areas. Poor families depend more on agriculture and natural resource sectors in general. And poor countries and poor people are simply less resilient overall, with fewer economic, human, and institutional resources to manage and adapt to these risks. So what does this imply for the G20 leaders? The heads of government will gather in Pittsburgh, lead countries that account for more than 80% of cumulative emissions of CO2, the main greenhouse gas. The summit participants know this, and they understand the magnitude of the risks. That's why they pledge to make the recovery, quote, green and sustainable, as well as inclusive. Yet the London communique included just a single sentence with a direct reference to climate change. Quote, we reaffirm our commitment to address the threat of irreversible climate change based on the principle of common but differentiated responsibilities and to reach agreement at the UN Climate Change Conference in Copenhagen in December 2009, unquote. The reality is that preparatory discussions for the Copenhagen negotiations have been extraordinarily tough, reflecting the treacherous domestic politics in all the major emitting countries and the tension between rich and poor countries about their respective emissions targets and financing obligations. The politics are especially worrisome here in the United States. The U.S. accounts for roughly one-third of the accumulated CO2 emissions that are driving temperature increases. And U.S. per capita greenhouse gas emissions are nearly 5 times higher than in China and more than 18 times higher than India's. The developing world rightly insists that U.S. leadership on climate should start with aggressive targets for emissions reduction here. Those of us in the rich countries who care about development must add our voices in calling for rapid U.S. emissions reductions, and we should push for more aggressive public funding for clean energy technologies here and abroad. After all, there are huge opportunities in the coming energy revolution. But in the meantime, the politics remains extremely difficult. We badly need confidence-building measures. Beginning now, I believe that all parties can agree in principle now on the importance of effective implementation of whatever agreement is eventually reached, beginning now to identify the functions and appropriate institutional arrangements as intrinsic value, and it can be a way of creating common ground that can help in getting to yes on a meaningful accord. Regardless of what agreement is reached in Copenhagen, or even whether an agreement is reached there at all, the community of nations will want and need institutional arrangements to execute a set of core functions that are fundamental to any collective response to the threat of climate change. These include, for example, reliable data and independent audit to verify compliance with emissions abatement pledges, regulation, management, and oversight of cross-border trading of emissions offsets, judicial-like functions associated with enforcement of agreements, as the WTO currently does with trade disputes, independent and disinterested review of developing country proposals for funding for emissions abatement and adaptation to climate change. That is fully acceptable. That is the disinterested review to all parties. The last function deserves a bit more explanation. Although climate is the ultimate collective action problem, country-based plans are likely to continue to be the basic building blocks of emissions abatement and climate adaptation. Under any future agreement, they will be the basis for allocating resources provided by the high-income countries, either bilaterally or through multilateral pooled funds. Who will decide which proposals are viable and which proposed costs are credible and which initiatives best leverage private capital and speed the spread of new technologies and what programs can be implemented effectively in what countries? Put another way, which global institutions should perform which functions? The ideal arrangement would deliver on these tasks in an effective, efficient, and equitable manner. Can existing global institutions do that? Are new institutions required? Is there a middle path that would build upon existing institutions, but with new incentives for the new tasks? On the one hand, new institutions take time and increase red tape. Though some of these tasks can and will be shared, for some there is no existing institution with both the capacity and the legitimacy to undertake them. In addition, some of the functions cannot be housed in a single institution because of the potential for conflict of interest. The G20 leaders must think strategically about which functions the world really needs and allocate them to institutions that can perform them best. Perhaps the conclusion will be that the world needs a new entity with a narrower focus, though personally I doubt it. While the arrangements to be pursued will necessarily and appropriately take place under the political auspices of the United Nations, that's my phone. It will stop. I forgot to turn it off. Take it away. I have wonderful CGD colleagues. They do everything for me. While the arrangements to be pursued will necessarily and appropriately take place under the political auspices of the United Nations Framework Convention on Climate Change, or UNFCCC, and its Conference of the Parties, the very qualities that make these legitimate as political bodies, broad representation, hinder their effectiveness as implementation bodies. The World Bank, with its comparatively strong technical and fiduciary capacity, raises a different set of challenges. Dominance of decision-making by the high-income countries undermines the bank's legitimacy. It is seen increasingly as a throwback to a G7 or G8 world in a G20 age. Many developing countries oppose the idea that the bank would vet their proposals for funding support for emissions reduction. They see this as an extension of the conditionality associated with bank adjustment lending in the 1980s and 90s, and more important and interesting, as subjecting their rights to climate financing to the indignities and ineffectiveness of typical foreign aid programs. Another major flaw is the conflict of interest that arises from a single institution housing both the lending and grant functions on the one hand, and any verification or judicial functions on the other. Still, to my mind, there are many benefits to tapping the expertise and capacity of the bank if, and that's a big if, it were possible to bolster legitimacy and insulate the implementation functions from the bank's seemingly endless preoccupation with making loans. The fact is, without an explicit international understanding that things should be otherwise, the World Bank will assume many of the implementing functions by default, a process that has, in fact, already begun. To resolve these problems, one approach is to establish an entirely new and legally separate wing at the World Bank with a clear mandate, mostly grant funding, and an entirely different governance arrangement with much greater power for developing countries. Such an entity would be more transparent, legitimate, and ultimately more effective. On the one hand, the lack of serious attention up to now to what functions are needed and which institutions should perform them is understandable in the light of the tensions surrounding the climate negotiations. On the other, it is unnecessary and counterproductive. The one thing that the multilateral institutions cannot do is sort it out among themselves. They do the bidding of their members and shareholders, the sovereign states whose leaders will gather in just 2 weeks in Pittsburgh. It can only help for those leaders to begin to grapple with this issue. Let me go to the second task for the G20, prodding the multilateral banks, the World Bank in particular, to develop and deliver a greatly expanded range of risk management products for poor countries. The global financial crisis has made millions of Americans acutely aware of the potentially high costs of systemic volatility. Millions of households have seen their retirement savings crumble, their jobs disappear, and more than a million families have lost their homes to foreclosure. These are real and painful losses. Yet they pale in comparison to the deprivation that millions of poor people in developing countries have suffered as a result of the same crisis. Not only jobs lost and small businesses underwater, as in the United States, but also undernourished babies that are permanently impaired and children leaving school to work the streets. These outcomes at the household level prevail even in many countries whose overall growth rates are recovering. In fact, for the world's poorest people, this fallout from this financial crisis is not that unusual. It is just one more in a seemingly unending series of negative shocks. Drought, flood, earthquake, typhoon, tsunami, a sudden spike in the price of the foods they buy, or a plunge in the price of the crops they sell. Why are poor people and poor countries so vulnerable to these shocks? A rich economy such as the United States is like a powerful ocean liner. Resilient in rough weather and choppy seas, its passengers partly insulated from the weather by protective stabilizers. Poor small economies are like flimsy, heavily laden boats, many packed with passengers, riding precariously low in the water. They are easily swamped by waves, think terms of trade shocks, for example. Or, as with the financial crisis that started here in the United States, by the wakes of the giant ocean liners speeding by. Making the flimsy boats more resilient could help, of course, but that's development, and that takes time. And many of the flimsy boats will always be small, even if they become more seaworthy. Since risks can't be eliminated, the flimsy boats need ways to manage risks. They need insurance. What does that mean for the multilateral banks? Right now, the global community provides grants and loans to help small economies deal with shocks. But with a few notable exceptions, including more generous and rapid credit lines the IMF is promising for low-income countries, negotiating a loan is a slow and uncertain process. That uncertainty, on top of the many other risks developing countries face, further deters investment. Worse, these loans are, in a way, the equivalent of the rich people in the ocean liners kindly offering to lend money to the poor people in the flimsy boats in order to patch up their vessels damaged by the giant ocean liners' wakes. I believe that the international community can do better. Guillermo Perry, Nancy Lee, and I have identified several risk management and insurance mechanisms that would offer significant improvement. I'll mention just three examples. global catastrophic reinsurance funds, building on programs such as the World Bank's weather insurance in the Caribbean, could help to ensure governments' and households' cash needs in the face of a natural disaster. Bonds linked to the terms of trade could enable countries to automatically reduce their debt service payments, that is, the payment they make on the bonds, if they are hit by a sudden price shock, such as a surge in the price of imported oil. Global and regional funds that would invest in the domestic bonds of frontier countries and firms would reduce the risks those countries face that are associated with foreign currency-denominated debt. As the reconstituted steering group for the international financial institutions, the G20 is in a good position to prod the World Bank and the other development banks to rapidly expand their offerings of risk management tools. To make their call for action more effective, the G20 should signal that future capital increases to all the MDBs will be based on their progress on this crucial set of innovations. And future capital increases are on all of their agendas at the moment. A little whiff of competition combined with sudden worry about the future bottom line might help the leadership of the World Bank and the other MDBs to overcome the entrenched culture of lending at any cost. Let me turn in closing to the role of the United States. In some ways, the situation today is not unlike that towards the end of World War II. Although we've been spared the cataclysm of global war, we are emerging from a crisis that has badly shaken global confidence and revealed to all the inadequacy of existing arrangements for collective action. During the 1940s, even before the end of the war, the Allies began the consultations that led to the creation of the United Nations and the Bretton Woods institutions, the IMF and the World Bank, institutions that helped make the second half of the 20th century much more prosperous and less bloody than the first. The United States was a leader in that process, rejecting the idea that the task of building a better world was too difficult or the promise too uncertain to warrant its best efforts. Instead, its leaders looked upon the creation of new institutions as an opportunity to shape the future around the world in accord with U.S. interests and values. Today, the United States has a similar opportunity to lead. I believe the institutional arrangements we devise now to address climate change and the other new risks that have accompanied globalization will be as important in the coming decades as the UN and Bretton Woods sisters were in the 60 years just past. Now is the time for the G20 leaders, today's equivalent of the leaders of the Allies in World War II, to begin serious deliberations on the design of institutional arrangements for addressing common global challenges, not only averting climate catastrophe, but also other global public goods, including especially reductions in global poverty. In Pittsburgh, President Obama has a golden opportunity to match the multilateral smart power rhetoric of his recent foreign policy addresses with decisive leadership and active collaboration with G20 members on matters that will end up affecting the welfare of billions of people. The Pittsburgh communique is nearing its final draft as we meet. But that doesn't mean that something of transcendent and lasting value cannot come out of this summit, even if it is primarily a matter of framing the agenda for the next meeting in Seoul. I hope that Pittsburgh won't be business as usual. I hope that President Obama and the other leaders will have the courage and the creativity to think through what is really required to create a global economy that is, as they promised in London, green, sustainable, and inclusive, and to prepare now for the crisis next time. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Nancy. It's now my pleasure to welcome and introduce our distinguished discussants. Tenancy's immediate left is Tim Adams. He is the managing director of the Lindsay Group and a former undersecretary of the United States Treasury for International Affairs. Tim was responsible for U.S. policy for the international financial institutions, including exchange rate policy, G7 meetings, how the world has changed, we're now talking about G20, IMF and World Bank issues. He regularly interacted with counterparts in key emerging markets, including China and India and Brazil, and has traveled extensively throughout the Middle East. To Tim's left is Francis Fukuyama. Frank is the Bernard L. Schwartz Professor for International Political Economy at the Johns Hopkins SAIS and the Director of SAIS's International Development Program. As you know, he is the author of many widely read, I should say, perhaps bestsellers, including The End of History and the Last Man, State Building, Governance, and the World Order in the 21st Century, and America at a Crossroads, Democracy, Power, and the Neoconservative Legacy. He is also the chairman of a new magazine, The American Interest. Frank, I want to start with you, and I should say our very distinguished discussants have generously agreed to help us organize our thinking about this with brief remarks, and then we'll open it to the audience and come back again to everybody on this panel to have a chance to hear their views. Frank, over to you. Thank you very much.
Okay, thank you, Lawrence, and thanks very much, Nancy, for inviting me to be on this panel. Well, I cannot find very much to disagree with in Nancy's overall proposals and the framework in which she analyzes things. It seems to me that the G20 now has become, as a result of the crisis, you know, the appropriate locus for international cooperation on a whole range of issues because it better balances legitimacy and effectiveness. I agree completely that the climate change issue, both from the standpoint of global poverty and as a general global public good issue, is almost a textbook case of the one that needs to be addressed first, and that we have a big opportunity as a result of the crisis. But I thought that it wouldn't be that interesting if I simply agree with everything, and so I think perhaps maybe playing the role for a bit of a kind of cranky conservative questioning whether these international institutions are actually up to the job of meeting these challenges might be appropriate. It's very a good thing that so many international agencies have shifted their focus to the question of global public goods, because I think that's an appropriate way of thinking about why you need international cooperation. The best analytical approach to this general problem that I've seen is the book that was written by my former SAIS colleague, Scott Barrett, a short book called Why Cooperate, where he uses some basic game theory to look at different global public goods issues and what the prospects are for actually achieving cooperation on them. And so he goes through a whole range of things, beginning with an asteroid strike on Earth and things like the eradication of polio, various public health kinds of issues, and finally global warming. And as a result of the theory, what becomes very clear is that of all of those public goods, addressing climate change is probably the single most difficult one, and one that runs into almost insuperable collective action problems. An asteroid strike is the easiest one because the United States unilaterally will simply provide what's necessary since it's going to get fried immediately when the asteroid hits. It's got a big interest to provide that public good, and that's been the basis for American provision of public goods historically, like global security, a global international trade order, all of which directly benefit the U.S. But climate change is an extremely difficult case because it requires what Barrett calls aggregate effort, meaning that unless everybody does their part, all of the major emitters do their part, they can completely nullify very strenuous efforts on the part of the other participants. And furthermore, it is the cost and the benefits of mitigation are borne by completely different players. And so the upfront costs to countries like the United States are going to be very high. The benefits years will actually go not even to the current generation of people living in the developing world, but as Tom Schilling says, they're going to go to the descendants of current people living in the developing world. And politically, that's a very hard thing to sell, that you are going to commit large amounts of resources to that kind of project. And it's, you know, unlike a lot of the other cooperation issues, it's one that really does require substantial resources to imagine that you're going to get any kind of progress. And so the question then is, how can the G20 itself, we all agree that it's more legitimate than the G7, and we want to leave that old G7 world behind, but in what ways can you structure decision-making within this new body to overcome some of those collective action problems? And, you know, there are a number of internal issues within the G20 that have not been resolved, but I think would have to be in order to really make this thing work. I mean, one is just the question of the agenda, because it does seem to me that one of the first questions you've got to ask is, if you saddle the G20 initially with a big problem that is admittedly important, but it can't solve it, what is that going to do for the credibility of that organization in the long run? And if, in fact, climate change is essentially an unsolvable problem, you may be able to contribute around the margins in terms of legitimating a certain kind of technical support, but it's not going to be good for the development of that institution if it takes on a task that it really is not capable of dealing with. And particularly the structure, you know, of the G20 is a little bit odd in a certain sense, because part of the reason that the G7 countries still have so much influence in the issues right now is that it remains the case that they put up the bulk of the resources. And in something like climate change, where resources are going to be important, essentially you're going to be asking rich country taxpayers to transfer resources to other countries. And under Nancy's model, I agree that ideally, that's right. You would want the governance of whatever body, from a fairly modest point of just providing technical support, but down the road, you know, if you're monitoring, is China complying with a carbon offset adequately, and are its factories really, spending the money the way they've committed themselves to? And if it's American taxpayers that are funding the scrubbers that are going into Chinese coal plants, are American, are people in this nice Congress we got down the street going to say, okay, we'll delegate this to a body that we don't control, that's actually controlled by these emerging market countries who have their own self-interest, in what kind of outcome you get. So I think that that's one of the big questions. I just think that at this moment when the shape of the G20 is up in the air, it's really important to think strategically about what set of issues it's capable of taking on and what the actual decision-making procedure set of institutions is within that body, so it actually does something that it can effectively accomplish and doesn't become like a lot of other international one of the big problems is that it's actually not a G20, it's actually a G30, because you've got all the ex officio heads of IFIs and you've got these regional organizations. And, for example, there's really no reason why Argentina should be in this group. They should kick it out, and they should include Spain, but they're never going to do that. So they're going to include both Argentina and Spain. And then if you include both of them, there's a whole lot of other people that are going to want to get into this. And before you know it, this G20-30 is now going to look like the G77. And I think unless without a little bit of, design, because that's really if you think about those early post-war institutions, the reason that they worked as well as they did was because the U.S. was really in the driver's seat. And so that is, I think, an important political consideration. Thank you.
Thank you, Frank. Without further ado, Tim.
Congratulate Nancy on her comments, but on the work of this institution, on the moniker, it notes practical solutions. And that's a great thing about Nancy. She always comes up with practical solutions, which for those of us who are in the policymaking world is always quite helpful. But she's also innovative, and today's comments is just another example of turning and thinking in an innovative way, and I want to congratulate her on her paper. It's also a pleasure to be up here with Frank Fukuyama, whose book you didn't mention on trust is an important work as you, it may be an important work to think about as you, to read as you think about the financial crisis over the past year and the important role that trust plays in society and in marriages and economic arrangements. It's a seminal work, and I encourage all of you to read it. Let me just say, some of this echo and phrase, I'll keep it brief. Nancy's right to focus on the G20, the G7. It's a nice group of people. It's a nice group of people to have dinner with, but it's really a larger, depending on who's paying. But it is the G20, or some semblance of the G20, is really the right grouping. We've moved beyond the smaller Europe-U.S. club, and it's and we're not going back. Whether the G20 morphs into something larger is a fear I have as well, but hopefully we can manage that going forward. Also right to focus on global public goods and the role of multi-development institutions in that delivery of global public goods. And I think right to focus on two of these key components, climate change, which I think of more as environmental sustainability, which I'll get to in just a moment, but also on the role of disruptive events and how it impacts the world's poorest, those who are most vulnerable. And I think far too often we think of, in terms of responses rather than risk mitigation, responses such as with the, when I was at Treasury, we put at the IMF a shocks facility to deal with commodity price swings in terms of the trade shocks that might affect vulnerable economies. But we really need to think about dealing with these issues beforehand and looking for various mechanisms, either provided or supplied by the public sector or encouraging private sector solutions to mitigate those risks at a time. So I want to congratulate you on that work. On the climate change, I agree with Frank. I think it's incredibly difficult. I don't think this Congress is ever going to pass a piece of legislation that has serious emissions reductions that doesn't include an agreement that involves China and India. I just don't think the politics will allow for it. And I think the Chinese and Indians are going to play this masterfully. I think we're going to have to bribe them. You didn't actually use that term, but that's exactly what we're going to have to do. And their opening bid, just some of the commentary out of Beijing over the past two or three weeks, the bribe is going to have to be exceptionally high. And given that last night the president talked about a $900 billion health care plan and we've got a $9 trillion deficit over the next 10 years, and we've got a $68 billion funding program for Afghanistan and Pakistan, and it goes on and on and on. You know, I have a hard time imagining that we're going to transfer hundreds of billions of dollars of U.S. taxpayers' money to Beijing in order to bribe them to do what's really in their own best interest anyway. Maybe the number is lower than that. But so I'm hopeful for Copenhagen, but I think it's part of a longer process. That being said, I think your points is you're absolutely right that we need to begin to think longer term, not just a year or two from now, but longer term, and put in place the institutional framework that looks at some of the issues you discussed, the trading facilities, the analytical capacity to monitor emissions, and then the ability to offer policy prescriptions that are individually tailored for each country and that can come up with the most optimal arrangement. Even if the Chinese, let's say, were to sign on to something historic in Copenhagen, there's really the issue of whether you know they're actually complying. And we don't have the mechanisms in place, either the technical or institutional mechanisms in place. So beginning to think about that ahead of time so they can't be used as an excuse in the future to avoid action. So I think you're right to think about these issues. Maybe rather than climate change, we should think about energy efficiency, which really gets at the heart of the risk mitigation. If you can address the ever-increasing energy needs of many developing countries and make them more sustainable, it not only gets at climate change, but it also gets at their external vulnerability to imported energy. And let me just close by saying I hope it's not, I agree with you, I hope it's not business as usual. And I think if we are going to achieve great success in Pittsburgh, it is going to be because of U.S. leadership. And I'm hopeful the president shows up with a full agenda and shows the same kind of passion there that he showed last night before the Congress. Thank you.
comments about that. I want to open it to the floor now, and I'm especially interested in the comments on what I see as essentially Nancy's core proposition that one important role of the G20 is to send clear instructions and signals to the international financial institutions around two sets of issues. One is identifying initially the functions that will be necessary to implement a climate agreement even before there is an agreement and begin to think about who should do what. And then the closely related function of becoming much more innovative and flexible in providing various kinds of mechanisms for coping with risk, various types of insurance. We are recording this. There's a mic coming around. I should put in an advertisement. In addition to providing the transcript, we hope soon to have the podcast online. So when you speak, please identify yourself by name and organization. I'll take the lady over here on the left initially, please. Making it hard for you, Heather. I've chosen somebody far from where you are. I apologize.
Hi, Heather Scott from Marketers International. Actually, neither of you commented on the proposal for the risk management mechanisms, and especially I'd like to ask Tim Adams if he could comment on the issue of the bonds for developing countries to mitigate risk, especially for natural disasters.
Tim, I'm just going to take that.
Sure. Look, I think it's worth experimenting and exploring a whole range of risk mitigation instruments. It's hard to know what will work ahead of time because it depends on the size of the country and the type of risk, the size of the economy, the type of risk that one is trying to manage. But I think the field is underdeveloped. There's not enough imagination and innovation. And if there is a lack of private sector interest, then there is a public sector interest in trying to find ways to get the insurance and reinsurance market interested. So I would say let 1,000 flowers bloom and let's see what works, but absolutely.
Frank, did you want to say anything about that? I understand Nancy Lee is here. We were privileged to have her with us as a visiting fellow when she worked closely with Nancy Birdsall and Guillermo Perry on this. I'd actually see you, Nancy. You're now back at Treasury. Would you like to say anything about this? May you? Can you? A superb diplomat in addition to being a very creative economist.
Well, I was able to speak more freely when I was a visiting fellow.
I don't think the... Is the mic on, Heather? We may swap it out. Sorry, Nancy. I apologize.
You see, Treasury is controlling my... as I was saying, I was able to speak more freely on these issues when I was a visiting fellow than when I was at Treasury and worked for Tim Adams, among others. I think the crisis has only increased the urgency, particularly on the risk management side, as Nancy was making the case. Because I think not only countries but households, poor households in developing countries, in poor countries, and in emerging markets with large poor populations, need tools. So it's a very logical thing for the institutions to do, for the development banks to do, but it's a hard thing to do, as Tim was suggesting. And I think there is actually variation in the capacity, in the human capacity, in the development institutions to pursue these kinds of activities. So I think there's a reality here that not every institution actually has people who know how to do these things. So I think one of the things that we have to do going forward is figure out which institutions are the logical candidates and then try to concentrate efforts there. That might make sense than trying to more sense than trying to ask every institution to do this kind of work. But I think in the context of the G20 discussions all along in this year, there have been voices saying over and over again that one of the functions of the development banks has to be to help countries manage risks and to help catalyze private flows in the context of situations where the private sector simply will not take all of the risk. There has to be some vehicle for the public sector to take risk in a catalytic way, not in a way in which all of the risk is borne by the public sector, but in a way, in a targeted way, in which it catalyzes private participation in some activity. So I think there's a lot of interest. I think my point really is, though, it's pretty hard. And so I think we will have to zero in on one or more institutions and really, really call for them to take some action on that.
Thank you, Nancy. Congressman Colby. Putting a little plug here, in addition to his leadership on aid effectiveness work when he was in the Congress, Congressman Colby is one of the winners of CGD's Commitment to Development Award. So we're very pleased to have you with us today, sir.
Thank you, Larry. And I'm very pleased to be here and to be able to listen to Nancy and the comments that were made. I want to be responsive to what Lawrence was saying about trying to get to Nancy's ideas there, but I'm having a little trouble getting there. When I think about how the G20 takes this leadership, we haven't been able to get the G20, much less the G7, to anybody else, to take the leadership, for example, on moving a trade agenda forward. Should we just presume, shrug, and say, well, trade's gone, we can't do anything about that, Doha's dead. Let's just move on to the next issue. And in this case here, it's going to be risk insurance and the global, the climate change issues. Or do we just say that, do we just ignore that issue? Or do we think that the G20 should be playing a role in that sort of thing?
Nancy, do you want to? I can't, that's a question for Nancy, essentially, isn't it?
Yeah.
I think the way I think about it allows me to bring a more hopeful perspective to what the G20 can do. I think of the G20 not as an organization or an institution. So it's hard to say we think it will work or not work. It's an informal setting where leaders of the major economies get together and talk. I believe, it's clear that the major developing countries want the G20 to be a steering group, as was the case of the G7 for the IMF and the multilateral banks, especially the World Bank. And I think that the United States and the Europeans realized the logic of that. It was very important in the context of what the G20 said and did in London to bring along, at least to try to bring along, the Chinese, for example, on making a contribution in some form to the emergency borrowing capacity at the IMF. That was part of building up the $1 trillion plus. So in that sense, what happened in London with respect to the IMF captured already the reality of a new world where sometimes the transatlantic powers need China at the table, and they are going to need India and other major emerging markets at the table on other issues. Now, that doesn't mean that they'll succeed in taking over, or even should try to take over, the Doha process and the trade negotiations. What it means to me is that they do have a special role that they will and are, they are assuming, and they did assume already in one respect in London, in telling the management and boards, which in a way is telling themselves, what to do at the World Bank and the IMF. But there's a mismatch still between the G20, which is is much more representative by its very nature, and the current allocation of power, influence, votes, and so on, and therefore the legitimacy of the institutions which are key to implementing anything that G20 and other leaders decide in any context that has to do with global public goods, where you need an implementer to get on with the work. You can say, we want to do this, we want to do that, we think these are the rules, but then there has to be an institutional day to day, week to week, month to month. So I see them as different, and that's why I would argue a little bit, even with Frank's point, that let's not saddle the G20 with a task that's impossible. Yes, it may be impossible to get to an accord. I mean, I hope not, on climate, but I don't think it's impossible for the G20, the leaders representative of the G20, to begin to say, we want the UN to deal with verification and compliance. Oh, but they don't necessarily have the technical capacity. We want the World Bank to do this and that. Oh, but that's not such a good thing because the World Bank loves to do loans. And maybe they'll do loans that are not consistent with an agenda of clean energy. That's easier in a way. It's tough, but it's easier. I see a difference.
Frank or Tim, did you want to respond to Jim's question? We'll come back on other things. I want to give you the opportunity if you want to.
It seems to me it's in the same spirit of what I was trying to say, is that at the beginning you've got to be really clear about what this organization is, you know, because they're if you open the floodgates to loading up its agenda with a lot of things that are not clearly related to the core economic coordination functions that the old G7 used to do, there's no telling where you're going to come out the other end of that. So I do think,
at the risk of doing exactly what Frank said, not to just load up the agenda, but to illustrate Nancy's point that we don't take positions at CGD, we certainly have not forgotten about trade. We have a trade working group that, in fact, issued a letter that's on our homepage this week about duty-free, quota-free access. And I think Randy Soderquist is here. I wonder, Randy, could you just give us 1 minute on that for those who are wondering, you know, has CGD abandoned trade? Emphatically not the case. No. Okay. I stand corrected. Nonetheless, I think it's an opportunity for you to put in a plug if you like.
Well, I'll be happy to put it.
You don't have to stand up because we can't see or hear you.
Well, okay. My name is Randall Soderquist. I'm at the Center for Global Development. Lawrence essentially has already captured what we've done. We do have a trade preference reform working group that consists of 19 very, very high-level individuals. The goal is to establish reform and coordination across trade preference programs. And this week we sent a letter to the G20 to discuss the issue of whether or not the leaders of the G20 would actually implement immediately and unequivocally duty-free, quota-free access, 100% duty-free, quota-free access, for developing countries. That's the gist of the letter. It's very, very simple. We can talk about whether or not it's feasible, but nonetheless, I think it certainly would be very useful. And I think it's a signal, without a doubt, that the leaders could actually say, we can come out of this with something that's very, very important. So, Jim, you and I share our views on trade at this stage of the game, especially as they relate to development. And we think this is actually a very, very good opportunity.
Just to be clear, Randy, for the primarily least developed countries, just to avoid any confusion.
Yeah, I think I'll collect several questions now. The gentleman here, Anupam, and the lady back on the aisle.
Is it working, the mic?
I can hear you. I believe it is, yes.
Okay. Ernie Pries, my name, Manufacturers Alliance. A quick comment on how to make how the G20 could be really work better. And then a couple substantive questions related, including trade. On the workings of these kind of groups, I've been around so long, I was one of a small group of people that secretly launched the first G5 meeting at Rambouillet, France. And it worked relatively well. This was a closed meeting and it was to respond to the immediate problem of first energy oil crisis. Then as it grew, G7, G8 has been sort of downhill. And, of course, the G20 is the right move now to make it more inclusive, but it's a bigger challenge when you've got 20-plus around the table. And that gets me to a substantive point. The Group of 20 can give general direction to these longer 20, 50-year issues such as climate change, energy security, but it seems to me the first G20 meetings appropriately and timely addressed the question of the recovery strategy from this Great Depression and such. And that's probably going to be, and should be, the immediate issue of 1 to 2 years or 3 years rather than 20 to 40 years of what's going to be the hard questions at Pittsburgh. And so my question is, how should that be focused? There is the question of exit strategies for these big fiscal monetary stimuli, and there's questions of banking reform and transparency, et cetera. But there's also a question that hasn't been addressed on trade. It's not just how we might finish the Doha round at some stage, but until 2 years ago, a central issue in the IMF or elsewhere was this growing global trade imbalance and related currency misalignment. And it was the Chinese surplus and the U.S. debt and manufacturers in the middle. And we wanted it, we wanted it on the agenda for recovery strategy in Washington and China opposed and others. It hasn't been on, but it's coming back. And this could really be a serious problem for trade policy. And I'll just give you, I'll just end with a couple numbers I was doing this morning. From June to July, and it's been going on 2 or 3 months now, U.S. manufacturers' exports June and July were down to $2 billion. They're going down. Whereas our deficit went up from $24 to $32 billion in 1 month. China in the other direction, its exports went up by $10 billion from June to July, and its surplus went up 27 to 34 by 7 or 8 billion. So it's got to come back up, but it seems to be getting off to a quicker start. So I wonder whether trade in the broader context of not getting us down in the wrong direction of a more and more imbalance, which is going to feed all the worst forces of protectionism, shouldn't finally be put on the agenda in Pittsburgh.
Mr. Prick, thanks very much.
I'm Anupam Khanna. I'm speaking as a private citizen. I'd like to respond to the question that the point that Frank made in response to the congressman's question. And my point is that's precisely the problem. The issue is controlling the agenda. Right now, G20 may appear to be better than G7, but at least the perception in developing countries, I've been spending the last year in India, is for how long is this going to last? Right now, perhaps the China and India are needed to be on the table, but they are barely having able to keep up with the agenda setting. To forget about formulating or giving constructive, detailed sort of guidance. So I think until and unless G20 does that, it cannot really function as a steering group. And this is where I think the fundamental question of legitimacy, Nancy, that you raised in the past, comes down to the fundamental of the process of fairness of institutions and principles guiding. I mean, Tim mentioned the issue of you have to bribe the Chinese to get that. No, I think that neither the Indians nor the Chinese expect to be bribed. For themselves, there is another set of issues about fairness to all the people who are going to bear the brunt of it. The issue is, can we agree on certain axiomatic principles of fairness? Could it be, for example, okay, there's no point trying to argue whether the Americans should consume 20 times as much today as the Indians, but can we agree that one generation down, perhaps two generations down, the people in both continents should have basically a similar shortage of opportunities? If those sort of principles that are agreed upon, I think it should be possible to come to an agreement on climate also, even the toughest parts.
Thank you, Anupam. One more question, and then I'll turn to the panel to answer any, all, or none of the comments and questions. Yes, ma'am.
Thank you. My name is Lisa Friedman. I'm with Climate Wire, and thanks for doing this today. It's been really interesting. My question also is for Nancy. The G20 finance ministers are looking very deeply at a lot of the questions that you raised. I mean, these papers that they've been writing have been kind of open secrets. We've written about them. Others have on how much money to raise, how to raise the money, what kind of institutions should be allocating the money, and how. If the communique, as you mentioned, is kind of a one-liner, and it's buried, and it's, you know, on climate change, and it's short and it's vague. And so I'm hoping that you could speak to that disconnect. Why do you think it is that there is a tremendous amount of really in-depth work going on at the G20 level looking at these issues that you mentioned of finance, but the public comments that we're seeing, you know, 3 months out from Copenhagen are still pretty limited. Is it a reflection of how difficult this issue is, this tension that some of the speakers just mentioned of, you know, some countries seeing this as an equity issue and others as a transfer of wealth or a bribe, or is there something more going on? And what do you hope, what is it that you'd like to see the G20 say about climate change or do? What is the thing that will push this forward? Thanks.
I was going to attempt to summarize the three, but I think you've been listening as carefully as I have, and I would just turn to Nancy, if you'd like to go first. You've got the privilege, or defer to your fellow panelists here. It's a wide range of issues.
I'd like to go last.
Okay.
Why not?
The prerogative of going last. The others are busily writing. Frank, are you ready?
Just on this last point, there's no dichotomy between seeing this as a resource issue and seeing this as an equity issue, because, I mean, it's really easy to agree to a general principle, I'll sign on to it today, that Indians and Americans should produce the same carbon footprint per capita. That's great. I agree with that completely for lots of reasons. But if you actually think practically about how you get to a point like that, I just don't see any, you don't have to call it a bribe, but quite legitimately, why should developing countries bear the cost of a public good where the majority of the harm has been done by developed countries already, which then should mean that you need a transfer of resources from those early emitters that have created the problem to the ones that can, so the equity, thinking through the equity issue in principle, then leads you to the, leads me to the conclusion that actually you do need a substantial resource component to this if you're actually going to get to a practical result. And that's where the, you know, the institutional problems of an organization like the G20, I just think, become very hard to, you know, very hard to imagine how they're really going to solve this thing.
Tim?
Sure. Indian G20 is imperfect, but maybe the least imperfect of all the other options. And sometimes you just have to work with what you've got on the playing field. But what's important is that leadership, right? With leadership, anything's possible. Without it, nothing is. And U.S. leadership especially is incredibly important on this. And I think the president has shown leadership on a number of these issues, but we'll have to continue to show leadership going forward, and we'll have to see leadership out of Europe and among the emerging markets. You're right, it is an equity issue. And how do we address equity issues? Then there may be some way of compensating, but I'm just trying to be absolutely practical. I just can't imagine the U.S. Congress passing a bill that doesn't include emission reductions by developing countries. And in some sense, you're not reducing emissions, you're just moving them. And at a time when unemployment is high and going higher for a considerable period of time, especially in your industry, it's just a political non-starter, and we can sit around and design wonderfully theoretical solutions, but at some point you got to roll up your sleeves and try to find a practical solution to get there. Trade should be on the agenda for the G20. I think it's tough, and it remains to be seen what this administration is going to do with trade. I don't know. We have the China pipe decision this week. We've got the tire decision, the Chinese tire decision on the 17th. You know, there'll be a number of data points along the way that'll give you some trend of where you think this president's going to take us. I don't know. But I hope that he continues to respond in a way that his predecessors on both sides of the aisle has responded, which is to continue to push to open markets, to free trade. I don't know that that's going to happen. It's probably difficult, again, given rising unemployment here and in other parts around the world, but if we can just hold steady through this period, I would consider that some success. You mentioned global imbalances. You're right. A number of countries, and I spent a lot of time wrestling with those issues, a number of countries don't like talking about them because they see that as a way to vilify them. I think the administration gave them a free pass, but it's my understanding that the White House is going to put this back front and center on future agendas, including in Pittsburgh. And I think I've heard Larry Summers and others say that the exit strategy and the reduction reduction of this stimulus should be done in connection with addressing the global imbalance. And you mentioned the trade-offs. The July numbers came out today, and they were horrible. Imports have surged. Some of that is a restocking in autos from the Cash for Clunkers program. But we thought we were making enormous progress over the next, and we're going the other way. And so that was some sobering news today. And these numbers bounce around, obviously. But when we thought some of these imbalances were actually correcting, there may be a whole host of reasons why they exist and why they'll be very difficult to deal with in the future. But absolutely, trade, to the Congressman's point, should remain front and center. And I'd like to see more of the discussion on the G20 on trade, too.
Nancy?
I think that was very important what Tim said about holding steady on the trade issue, where I do think there was more holding steady as a result of the G20 summits than there might have been. But what I want to say on that issue is a little bit different. The global imbalance problem is, you know, can be crudely characterized as a problem on the U.S. side, too much buying and consuming and importing, and a problem on the Chinese side, too much saving, and so on and so on. It's often characterized as having to do with the Chinese are manipulating or not their foreign exchange rate. What's very interesting is that everyone knew about this for the last 5+ years. And in the IMF, there were tremendous efforts to bring together the key parties to discuss this issue. But the fact is that even in the IMF, and certainly up to now, it's very difficult for an institution to discipline the most powerful members. And the U.S. was also not disciplined. It's not just the Chinese that could not be disciplined. It was the U.S. that could not be disciplined. That's, you know, the nature of the game. On the other hand, at least we have in these international institutions the norm, the value that most of the time all the members are willing to bind themselves to certain understandings and rules. Of course, sometimes it doesn't work. Power relations matter. But for many things, it does work. And it was obvious that this was a problem, and there's been a lot of discussion about what might be done about it. So, you know, that's the point I want to make, that institutions, they carry some weight that is worth structuring around, that the clubs, the leaders, when they get together once or twice a year, can't handle on their own. On the principle, on the climate change issue, I'd just like to say that I think there is a principle that I've been developing in a research sense with a colleague at CGD, and I put it as developing countries should not need to sacrifice development because of climate change problems. And people in developing countries should not have, over time, lesser access to the services that energy provides than have and will people in the rich world. It's possible to imagine honoring that principle with lots of reductions or abatement of emissions if we have cleaner technologies. And I refer you to the tremendous work of David Wheeler, among others, on this score. I think that we can do it as a world. Now, on the questions from the colleague from ClimateWire, it's very interesting to me that even your question had to do with the assumption, and much of what Frank said on climate change has to do with the assumption that it's all about financing from the rich countries for the poor countries. What I'd like to emphasize is the issues I raised in terms of functions that are not allocated yet. They're not costly. The only one, none of them, actually, and the speech is written out, and you can look again at those functions. They didn't have to do with the financing. They had to do with who's verifying, who's monitoring, who's credible on compliance. compliance. These are not expensive activities. And the problem that I was trying to outline is that the World Bank, among others, is used to spending money. So it has neither the mandate nor the culture right now to undertake those any of those other functions. But the United Nations groups don't have the technical in-country and fiduciary capacity. That's the point that we need to think about. And those functions are the global public goods functions that have to be carried out under any accord, and that many of which can be carried out sooner and may actually contribute to making the accord more possible. You asked why the disconnect between what the G20 is saying and doing on climate change. And I think you were right. Some of it is the tension between rich and poor countries, in particular China and India. They don't want to have a lot of discussion about money and transfers until the rich countries, especially the U.S., make commitments on emissions reductions. And they associate talking about something that some institution like the banks would do as all about money and transfers. But as I've just tried to clarify, it isn't all about money. It doesn't have to be. What we're not talking about enough is these other functions, which I think, you know, my whole point is the G20 should start the leadership talking amongst themselves and thinking through what are the implications going forward. There was a comment about 10 to 20 years, 1 to 2 years. Yes, it's appropriate for the G20 now to be concentrating on, you know, exit strategies, banking issues, the coordination on regulatory problems in the financial sector. And they will primarily talk about that. And that's what you will hear about in the media. But I think in the development community in particular, we have an obligation to inspire them to think, if not 20 years ahead, at least 2 or 3 years ahead, and get some of these broader issues like risk mitigation and implementing a climate accord on the agenda in Seoul.
Thank you, Nancy. And maybe stepping out of my chair role for just one moment, I think just building on what you said, and correct me if you disagree, but I think in addition to making it easier to reach an agreement and responding to the concerns Tim raised about the Congress passing something, it's pretty easy for me to imagine a situation where there was agreement, and among the criticisms raised of it in the Congress is, well, we should never agree to this because it won't be enforced, and the Chinese won't do what they promised to anyway. So if we can begin to work on the mechanisms for verification and reliable data, that may not only help in reaching agreement, but helping to sell one. There are a lot of hands. I won't be able to get to everybody. I do want to recognize Leslie Rotman of Reuters, who, if you don't know already, does a terrific job of covering the multilaterals. Eric Vogt and John Ruthrop in front of Eric. If you'll keep it brief, please. I am going to try and end pretty close to our announced time of 3:30. Thank you, Leslie.
Thanks for that pick. yes, as you know, I covered the multilaterals for a very long time now, and one of the big issues, as you know, is the issue of quotas. U.S. sources have told us that Washington wants to bring this up at the G20. European sources are saying, have confirmed this. The question is, do you think some sort of deal can be struck at this G20? Or what sort of message should be sent, you know, to countries to move along with the quota reform by 2011?
Eric?
Eric Fortenberg, University. Thank you for the invitation, and I'm glad I came. But I'm leaving this gathering puzzled, nevertheless. And I wanted to address an issue that has been raised throughout the afternoon. Much was made of the legitimacy and the representation of a G20 versus a G8. G20 is better than a G8 because it's more representative. But still in all, it is self-selective, it is exclusive, and it is a club. And the question is, how do you bridge the gap between making something workable in a group mechanism in between do you need to work with to get to some kind of practical approach and solutions that can then be moved on to a UN-type representation and legitimacy factor? And perhaps one way of doing that is by realizing that while the G20 is mighty, it is not almighty and is not all-powerful. It will need to probably draw on non-member states occasionally, or the business sector, or the civil society, or even think tanks, to give it a sense of input that it needs to make sure whatever decisions it makes is representative of the issues are that are on the table and can actually gain the international universality it needs to become really truly legitimate. So is there a way that a network type approach where you bring countries, institutions on a need basis, depending on the issues you talk about, to make sure that the discussions you have are so enriched that when it comes out of the G20 and goes into a kind of a UN type forum, that it will have the support that it needs to become universally acceptable? Thanks.
Thank you, Eric. John.
Thank you. John Ruthroff with Interaction. Nancy always comes up with very innovative ideas, and actually when you said the $1 trillion how many months ago, I'd never thought they'd approach that, but they have, at least in a pledge. I'd like to ask you about the role of non-government organizations. As you know, we do a lot of work on the G20, and we're coordinating an NGO hub in Pittsburgh for European and U.S. and Canadian NGOs. So that's one. And the other is, have you talked or discussed this with the environmental groups like World Wildlife Fund or USCAN, or there are now a number of development agencies that are doing a lot of work on climate, like Oxfam and ActionAid?
Okay, we've got three questions. One is about a deal on quotas. The other has to do with maybe perhaps broadening the G20 legitimacy so that what it comes up with would be acceptable to a much broader forum, such as the UN. And finally, about sort of reaching out and involving NGOs in these ideas. Those sound to me like they're mostly for Nancy, but I don't know if the panel members have other things they want to say about these
things. I thought it would be interesting to hear from Tim on the quotas. So now a third party, but who was there before?
Sure. I have no inside knowledge on whether there's a quota deal or not. I used to spend countless hours locked up in conference rooms all about 10th and 1 percentage point transfers. It seems so petty given the amount of time we spent on it. I would just urge them to be incredibly ambitious because, and I spent a lot of time on the phone, but I think this applies to all these institutions. It needs to be regarded as a universal institution. It needs to be seen as legitimate. And I act on behalf of all its shareholders, and I think the fund's governance structure has not kept pace with the changes in the global economy. Should reflect it. But, you know, with all these kinds of changes, it's a zero-sum game. There are winners and losers, and the losers don't like to lose. And when you have quota representation where Belgium has a larger share than China, that obviously on the face of it is inequitable. But if you live in Belgium, you don't want to give up anything, especially if this is seen as some sort of symbolic slap that you have lost something in a globally recognized institution. So the politics are delicate, requires enormous diplomacy. And I would advocate that if you're going to take the issue on, be bold, be aggressive, think even larger than quotas, but design the kind of institution you want, and then with leadership, I think you can get there. Whether that's done in Pittsburgh in a few weeks remains to be seen.
Frank, I'm going to give Nancy the last word, so that means you're next to last. Would you like to say anything in closing?
Well, yeah, actually. I didn't say anything about the risk mitigation, but I want to just mention that. I have a former student that's been working on weather derivatives in Africa, and it does seem to me that this is an extremely good idea because, you know, you're smoothing risk in countries that are inherently much riskier than other countries. And as I understand it, you know, private insurance markets are not going to fill that role, and if you don't have a strong, you know, public backing for the development of those kinds of instruments is just not going to happen. And so I would support that very strongly.
Thanks very much. Before I ask Nancy to give closing words, maybe I'll say something about, I see this very much as the beginning, not the end of the conversation. I saw a lot of hands coming at the end. We will not only have the text of the speech available for you to pick up as you leave the room, if you'd like to take a copy with you, it'll be online. I mentioned we hope to have a podcast, and there'll also be a blog posting, which I will post. And the advantage of that is not so much what I have to say in the post, but it opens a comment field. So I hope that those of you who didn't get a chance to speak from the both with your questions and your comments. With that, Nancy, I give you the floor.
Thank you, Lawrence. Leslie, on the quota issue, I think Tim, I forget how he said it, but it's really sort of marginal in some ways to the fundamental distribution of power, which has to do with, you know, the Europeans have too many chairs, the U.S. doesn't need to have the effective veto it has with the 85% rule. I think that something like double majority voting, the way it's done in Europe, would give much more voice to a lot of small, poor economies. And whether they go from, you know, 0.3% to 0.5% is just not that important. So I hope that in the media, the sophisticated media that talks about these things, it's not only all about the quota. In fact, I think they'll reaffirm that they want to get to finish this quota reform on the schedule that they've set, which is a little faster than it might have been without the discussion in London. Eric, I think your point about a network approach is absolutely fundamental. I think that emerges anyway. I mean, the voices of civil society, the think tanks, that's what we're all about even here today. It doesn't have to necessarily be formalized. I don't think that anybody should presume right now that the G20 is embedded forever. Vij Ramachandran, who's here, has a terrific paper. You can find it on our website. It has a simple rule that countries that represent at least 2% of world population or 2% of world GDP should be represented in the room, and then there should be some mechanisms for bringing, on a rotating or regional basis, other smaller economies to the table. So I encourage you all to look at that. But, you know, it's a tough nut to crack to have a small enough group to have a good discussion, as Congressman Colby sort of implied, and a large enough group to be representative. And in fact, the network reality is what compensates for the shortcomings indirectly of any such official, even if it's just a club, any such official gathering. And finally, John, on the role of NGOs, it is related to the question about are we in a more networked world? And there's a very interesting, you probably know more about it than I do, but a group of NGOs has put out a position for Copenhagen, right, that is quite interesting. So we do have mechanisms in this web-linked world for those kinds of contributions to be not only made, but I think heard increasingly by the officials who are sitting at the big tables. With that, thank you very much.
I will perhaps add one more housekeeping thing. Some of you may know already that Dominique Strauss-Kahn, the managing director of the IMF, will be giving a talk for the center. I believe it's a week from today, Nancy. Is that correct? It's not in this venue. It's at 1616 P Street. It's currently on our website. If you didn't get the invite already but would like to come, you can go to the website and reserve. And he has some very interesting ideas about reforming the IMF. And if you're interested in those issues, I'd encourage you to join us.